Today is March 3rd, 2017, and this is an oral history interview of Ann Laser from Mill Valley. My name is Joyce Kleiner, and I'll be conducting the interview. Okay, so...
So Robin is 56.
That's your daughter, Robin.
Right.
Okay.
And she works for the Country Dance and Song Society. She lives in Massachusetts, which is where I grew up. My next daughter is Kate, and she's 54. She's a congregational minister without a parish, and runs something called the Friday Cafe for the Homeless in Cambridge, Mass, and just got an award from the mayor of Cambridge, which is very exciting. And then my son, Philip, is just turned 50. He works. He lives in Alameda, and he works at a law firm. He's a paralegal in San Francisco.
Also, I want to put on this form where you went to college because you mentioned Radcliffe.
Radcliffe 59. At a time when there were only 300 women at Harvard.
Yeah. Even the fact that it's called Radcliffe, you know, do you ever have to explain that to anybody?
It's called Radcliffe because the first large donor to Harvard was named Ann Radcliffe.
But there's no Radcliffe now. It's all Harvard. Right?
There is, because there's a Radcliffe Institute,
postgrad,
which is doing very well. So.
Okay. So now, let's start with your experiences, where you were born, and a little bit about that time, and I'm going to just sort of...
Okay.
I might stop you at one point.
I was born in the Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston, where my father was on the staff and chief of the diabetes clinic. And my mother did things like the League of Women Voters, but she also was a dancer, and she danced with the New England Conservatory of Music.
Ballet dancer?
It's modern dance, not ballet, but it was classical modern dance. Mm-hmm. And she danced in some amazing operas and stuff like that. So she was a very energetic, almost overwhelming person. Mm-hmm. and there were four children in my family. And I went to public school for kindergarten and first grade. And then, like everyone in my family's circle of friends, the children all went to private school. The private school that I went to suited me very well because it was, in a way, a liberal in its... It was not so conservative, and it was known for the fact that you didn't have to be necessarily brainy to go to this school, but they did love to have artists and drama, and the program was extremely rich in those areas. I did a lot of music and drama.
What was the school called?
Beaver Country Day School.
Beaver?
Because of some connection with Beaver, Pennsylvania, which I can't remember. But the day we were in school from 9 o'clock until 4, mm-hmm. and a lot of that time was spent with activities having to do with art and music and drama. So in that regard, it was a very rich program. But I also there were only 55 girls in the class I graduated from, and now of course the school is co-educational. But in those days that was highly unlikely. We did very well, though. There were five from the class of 1955 that went to Radcliffe. So that was a significant proportion, which is just remarkable.
So this school went all the way through high school?
It went from nursery school to 12th grade.
Oh, okay.
Right, so my little sisters were there, too. I was not particularly... political until high school, and And my parents changed their party registration from Republican to Democrat. And that had a profound effect on me. It was the first election was 1952, and it was Adlai Stevenson. And the most of the students in my school were Republican. The faculty were Democratic. Some of the staff was the kids who lived in Cambridge, the Jewish girls, and me. And another characteristic of Beaver was that it was the only private girls' school that admitted Jews. Mm. And they would have admitted Catholics, but the Catholics all went to Catholic schools. Right. So it was quite striking that girls who wanted to go to private school went to Beaver.
Now, was this in Boston, or was it in
It was in Brookline, which is a large suburb of Boston.
Is that where you lived, Brookline?
I lived there. I could walk to school. Okay. It was actually called Chestnut Hill, and a small part of Brookline, which called itself a town, but is the largest town in the world.
Yeah.
Right. So then having my, you know, a waking up politically at that age really was life-forming for me.
Mm-hmm.
And my major in college was American government.
I'm making sure that's on. Okay. American government was what you studied at Radcliffe.
Right.
Okay.
Right. And there were exciting times for the 1956 election. The three Stevenson sons were all in Cambridge.
Mm.
The oldest at the law school, the youngest a class ahead of me, and the middle one living a debauched life somewhere. But I was co-chair of the Radcliffe Young Democrats, and the thing that gave my life meaning besides singing was politics.
So you did you sing like in concerts and in performances? And
yes.
Did you fantasize about becoming a singer? Maybe
I thought I was very interested in the theater in general, but and also in singing, mostly as a chorister, but also good enough to get the alto roles in Gilbert and Sullivan, things like that. And I sang some solos at Radcliffe, which was a great honor, but. Mostly it was as a choral singer, and it was something that I continued with after college. I was singing in a chorus in Marin County that lost, in the Tam District, that lost its funding with Prop 13. So that was the last singing. But we Bob and I are addicts for concerts, classical concerts, so that was another very profound impact on my life.
By the way, do you belong to the chamber or society?
No.
So
I don't know, you know, I don't know if I'm under what auspices I would be in the Chamber of Commerce.
No, I don't mean that. The Chamber Music Society or whatever it is.
Oh, Mill Valley Chamber Music.
Yeah,
yeah, we go to that.
Yeah, okay.
But they are suffering from many of the same things. We were going to a concert in Berkeley, and we couldn't find the hall where it was being held. So we stopped someone to ask it directions, and he said, "Just follow the gray hair." And I was affronted, and then I looked, and everyone going to the chamber music concert was all elderly, and it continues to be true. And they're beginning to die off. At the last few chamber music concerts, they've been giving pep talks about how they, you know, they aren't going to be able to go on much longer unless we start bringing in some younger people. The only young people at these concerts are the musicians.
Yeah.
And it is a phenomenon that to me that's very distressing. There's nobody in the league under the age of 50, I'm sure. But I joined when I was 30.
Yeah, let's not get ahead of it because I want to make sure we talk a lot about that. So once we're there, we're not leaving. So tell me about when you met your husband and when you came to Mill Valley.
Right. I met him through the Democratic Party, that the a Harvard political type at the law school had been friends with Bob at college. He went to Harvard, and so did his brother. And I had known him vaguely, but when I was a sophomore in college, my parents were hit head on in one of the new Volkswagens that had the engine in the rear instead of the front, and they were very severely injured. My father was in the hospital for 9 months and my mother for 6 months. And my sister and I got...
you know what, I'm going to interrupt you. It's possible that sound got into the recorder. Okay. Sorry.
just nerves.
I know.
My sister and I got jobs at the Mass General Hospital so that we could visit our parents more easily. And Bob was then an intern at the... Right, and so I actually told a friend, I was interested in Bob and told a friend, tell Bob I'm working at the Mass General this summer. And we started going out then. And it was very comforting to have a boyfriend who was a doctor. He's 6 years older than I am. And my father really fell for him. And that was very striking because my father once said when he was a freshman in college, there were two rules that you must not obey. You do not go outside without a hat on, and you are never in the company of a Jew.
Who said that? Your dad said that?
My father said that was what the main rule was. He said it rather bitterly.
So he was saying it in a disparaging way, not...
Oh, yes.
Okay. I think...
Right, but that was, you know, because the enrollment of Jews at Harvard is so incredible. And at Radcliffe, too, the president of Radcliffe said, I could fill the class at Radcliffe with well-qualified students from a single high school in New York, and I... thought I knew which one it was, but anyway, about 30% of the population at Radcliffe is Jewish.
Mm-hmm. Right. But your father didn't carry the same biases.
No,
okay.
No, and as a matter of fact, the best thing I did was to marry a neurologist because it was so helpful to him to have a neurologist in the family.
So Bob is Jewish, is that?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Right.
All right. So
from Cleveland, and his parents. They weren't drummed out by the Nazis, but the sort of the pre-Nazis. They really had to leave. I love the story of America, where a family flees essentially from Europe, comes to America, and produces three sons who have PhDs in science are science professors.
When I turn off the recorder at the end, ask me to remind you to tell you a story, okay?
Okay. Right. So, you know, when people talk about the immigrants, it just makes my blood boil.
Yeah.
Because I know why my family, on my father's side, who were, you know, Anglicans, Episcopalians, they were immigrants. Their ancestors were immigrants, and it just and for good reason.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my grandparents were from Sweden. Okay, so you eventually married Bob, and did you stay? When did you come out to Mill Valley? I want to get back to the politics, but I want to get the early years.
Well, first, Bob, when he finished 3 years. Of an internship and residency at the Mass General, and he had chosen to be a neurologist and decided to go to New York to the Columbia's Neurological Institute. Mm-hmm. So we moved to New York, and then doctors were subjected to the draft. So in the middle of his residency in New York, he was drafted into the Navy. And
what year was that?
That was 1959. And to Camp Pendleton in Southern California.
Mm-hmm.
which is very interesting. And we had our first baby there and half of the second baby there. And that was interesting. But, and it was, New York had been, felt so hectic and so rushed that it was sort of it was like a vacation in a way to be in Southern California. But I never thought we'd end up in California. We went back to New York, and then Bob's boss at UCSF recruited to be chief of neurology at UCSF, which had a very tiny department, and he recruited several people that he'd known in New York. So to Bob, this was the chance of a lifetime. For me, less of it, because I did regard myself, and I think this is what I told you, that I was an Easterner, and it was all right to go to California for 2 years and lie around in the sun and have babies, but to actually live there was a tremendous shock. And in some way, along this time, I got pregnant with the third baby, and we put off Bob's going into the Navy. But we finally went when the baby was 12 weeks old. But by then, I was really having quite a serious postpartum depression, and was on medication. And not happy, and feeling at that point that all the glory, all the praise, would go to the husband and the wife. She could be a good wife, she could be a good mother, but nothing of the scope and the scale.
Okay, so can you remember where you were when I interrupted you? I'm sorry.
I guess I was talking about the fact that I was living in Mill Valley and struggling with feelings of depression, both of inadequacy but also kind of powerlessness.
Did you feel that, having gone to Radcliffe, did you feel that you were putting pressure on yourself to do something? Did that have anything to do
with
it?
Well, certainly, if the pressure didn't come from me, it certainly came from Radcliffe.
Yeah.
Radcliffe made a big effort to show that we were as good as the guys.
Mm-hmm.
Really. And the fact that one in three applicants got into Harvard, but it was one in eight applicants got into Radcliffe, and that kind of nonsense. But it certainly, I did feel that the fuss was made over the ones who, when they graduated from Radcliffe, went to graduate school and went to medical school and law school and stuff like that. And I didn't even do that. I got married. Mm-hmm. But that had a lot to do with what Bob needed.
Mm-hmm.
But also, I was the head of the family with my parents. So
the accident.
Yeah, gravely injured. And my mother permanently brain damaged.
Really?
Yeah. So I felt, you know, that for the 2 weeks I took off to start how we would reorganize our lives with my parents in the hospital, I became the head of the family, including really helping to take care of my 12-year-old sister. Another sister was at boarding school, and my brother had graduated from college and was gone. So I was the head of the family.
How were you able to finally move to California under those circumstances?
Well, we didn't do it until we moved to New York after I graduated.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a job, actually. I took the civil service exams and was a U.S. government bureaucrat in New York City, working in Social Security.
And commuting back and forth to Boston? Or
a little
Paris?
Bit. Some I did, but mostly it was from 161st Street down to Greenwich Village.
Okay. So you were still responsible in managing your parents' care for me.
Well, not as much as I could, but about that time, I sort of had handed it on to my younger siblings.
Mm-hmm.
And and life was so different. The pay of doctors was so abysmal. We were below the poverty line, and my husband was needy too, because the hours were just impossible. 36 hours on and 8 hours off.
It really hasn't changed either.
I don't know if they're allowed to work so long that they're on for 36 hours at a time. So I didn't have any career in mind, mm-hmm. and I certainly, working at Social Security, knew I didn't want to be a government bureaucrat. That was authorizing checks to be sent to the mm-hmm. beneficiaries and then stopping their checks because mm-hmm. they had been caught having a job or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
In a room that was as big as a basketball court, mm-hmm. with bureaucrats at the desk.
Doesn't sound like you.
I didn't want to, but anyway, I was making more money than Bob was at that point. So coming to San Francisco for a while seemed like a disaster. We lived on Paradise Drive in the apartments for a year before, and found this house in Mill Valley.
And what neighborhood do you live in Mill Valley?
It's called Scott Highlands. It's two blocks beyond the golf course.
Mm-hmm.
And
I know where that is.
Right.
And there's a little park there.
That's right. Right. Mm-hmm. And the owner of the house, I think, had bought the house to as an investment, not to live in it, but as an investment. And when we went through the house, I'd been looking for about 14 months, and because of the prices were so shocking. And when I went through this house, I saw the Harvard alumni magazine on the table, and I said, "Oh, we have this one too." When we bought the house, he persuaded the bank to give us a lower interest rate because of the Harvard connection. He had the power to do that because he was the treasurer for BART.
Oh.
So he was always going to Wells Fargo or whatever it was with vast sums of money, and so he had that kind of power. So we had a quarter cent smaller mortgage.
So what year was this that you actually...
This was now 1967 was when we bought the house in Mill Valley in 1968. We bought the house, and the baby was 18 months old.
That was your third.
My third and mm-hmm. final, yes. And the girls were kindergarten and second grade.
So which elementary school then?
Park School.
Park School, right?
Park
there was
School.
Was there even an Ed McGuire yet at all?
There was.
Park School, of course. Yeah, right. It's right about
it was a kind of junior high school.
Ed McGuire was.
Yeah, right.
Okay, so I want to make sure we spend plenty of time talking about your passion. So I want to get a little bit more of the background now. Your kids went to Park School. You lived in Scott Highlands, which is above the golf course, which is Boyle Park area. And you have now three children. Now Bob, I assume, is... What is he commuting into UCSF at that
right.
point? And so you're getting settled in Mill Valley. And so
right.
two questions. One is, what was Mill Valley like in 1968? And what was it like to be a mother for you?
Right.
And also I know that at one point you told me that there was something exciting about California too. Because in the East Coast there were all of these standards and expectations, and you didn't feel that here. So I'd like to hear about that, if that's true.
Right.
So,
when we were looking for a house, on taking one trip, it may have even been to Scott Highland. I asked, "Where's the Jewish neighborhood?" And not knowing whether our family would be considered Jewish or not.
Oh.
And the answer was, "What's that?" And I thought that put a positive slant on on moving to California, because I had thought of California as inferior to New England, mm-hmm. and that I was not comfortable. But the idea that someone would say, "What's a Jewish neighborhood?" was mm-hmm. just astounding to me. Really,
yeah.
I could have drawn in Brookline. I could have drawn on the sidewalk with chalk where the Protestant neighborhood, the Catholic neighborhood, and the Jewish neighborhoods were.
Mm-hmm.
And it was not nice. It's much better now, but still. When my father went to sell our house in Brookline, a neighbor called and told him not to show the house to Jews.
Mm-hmm.
And my father said, so I called every Jewish person I knew to say that the house was for sale.
Well, now, to balance things a little bit, it has to be said that there were probably a lot less Jews in Mill Valley, you know. So,
right.
I wonder if how much credit Mill Valley deserves, or any California town deserves, for not having. Well, they didn't have Catholic neighborhoods, and we had plenty of Catholics. So,
but there were plenty. I think that when my children were going through, my children. They just weren't aware in the same way. They didn't know who the Jewish students were.
Mm.
Whereas you would be branded on day one.
Okay.
And so in that regard, there was something so much more relaxed that made life easier. At the same time, however, we were falling into tremendous political turmoil over the wars.
Mm-hmm. That's right. You were here during a kind of a tumultuous time.
Right. And it was tumultuous in the schools for many reasons. The teachers had won the right to collective bargaining, and that was quite disruptive. The population of the school district, for reasons that were poorly understood, began to decline, and declined in a severe manner, so that three elementary schools in Mill Valley were closed. So this is a time when I begin to become interested in the political considerations. I had agreed to be president of the PTA at Park School without ever having attended a PTA meeting in my life, but they had asked everybody else, and the one who was retiring was a neighbor in Scott Highlands, and I agreed to do it, and that was the best decision I had made. I didn't know at the time that the principal had actually suggested my name to the desperate nominating committee when they came to say they were empty-handed. He said to try for me, and I don't know why. But that gave me a kind of a stature and importance that was missing from my life. And it really helped me to get over the feeling that Bob was getting all the goodies and I wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
There was a terrible clash between the conservatives and the liberals in Mill Valley. The school board meetings were extremely tumultuous.
Now, at that time, the majority was Mill Valley residents were still Republican, probably, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, but they were in the process of turning over.
Mm-hmm.
The anti-war politics.
Mm-hmm.
And the Nixon era, that kind of corruption,
mm-hmm.
The differences in politics became much clearer, and the school programs were being kind of dismantled. There were classrooms where they had places where the children could lie down, and they could put their desks wherever they wanted to,
mm-hmm.
And the teachers thought that teaching about the sort of the politics of liberalism was much more important than teaching reading, writing, and arithmetic. I mean, the conservative attitude toward the changes that were taking place, and indeed, it was disturbing. It was similar to this in that what everyone thought of as normal was being dismantled. Mm-hmm. I remember at a conference with a teacher who opened a drawer and you saw that the whole drawer of his desk, this big drawer at the bottom, was filled with bubble gum, and he would throw it to the kids in the class. The middle school was made with an open classroom format, so that it was noisy and disorganized. The teachers had to yell in order to be heard.
Is that when they had the pods?
The pods, mm-hmm. Yeah. They did have sliding doors, but it really wasn't the same. It was the idea of having a school that was a one-room school, everybody mixed up together, and what you were teaching them was more how to be ethical and how to be generous and how to be noble, and never mind the academics, it's so that it was. And then that you combined it with declining enrollment, so that one school after another was closed. And I have people who still hate me because they think that I was not ready to defend Park School enough. Mm-hmm. My attitude was, I'll send my kids where the school is, and mm-hmm. it doesn't have to be Park School. I can't say I can't tell the school board the population has become so small in this school that you cannot have a full kindergarten, you cannot have a full first grade. You've got to have combined some schools. And I felt it was intellectually dishonest to say, close any school but Park School. I had to be willing to. And there are people who when they see me in the aisle at the Safeway, will turn around because they think I was so much betrayed.
Well, the school didn't even close, though.
No, it didn't. It stayed open.
But just the thought that you were willing to listen. Yeah.
Right.
Now, how many schools were there before they began to close?
I think it went from 8 to 5. Well, anyway, they closed Alto School. They closed Homestead School. Was it Tam Valley? I think Tam Valley. And other schools were considered untouchable, like Old Mill. Nobody would talk about. Nobody would even think of closing Old Mill. And I think Park was somewhat. These are schools on the main drag that mm-hmm. you.
Well, also inside the city limits too.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So, I don't. I think I was just president for 2 years. And then became, I started my new career as a newsletter writer.
For the PTA.
For the PTA. Mm-hmm. But by this time I had, because of the tremendous crisis in the public school system in California, people began to cluster in the school people, the trustees, the PTA, the League of Women Voters, many organizations joined together to try and protect the schools from what they're facing, including that there was the dismantling of a kind of an academic atmosphere, the closing of schools, and a case from the Supreme Court called Serrano versus Priest, which said that it's unconstitutional for a dollar on the property tax in a wealthy neighborhood produces 10 times as much money as a dollar on the property tax in a poor neighborhood. They compared two side by side school areas in Los Angeles, and the Supreme Court said that was unconstitutional. Mm-hmm. So I was asked, as an American government major who had read many Supreme Court decisions, to read this. That was one of my first assignments in PTA, was to read Serrano versus Priest and explain it. And that was another pat on the back that did me good. First I explained it to the PTA. I was asked to explain it to the school board. I went to the teachers' unions. I went all over the place. The League of Women Voters, explaining Serrano versus Priest. So I became then a school board regular, explaining issues and explaining what was going to go on. I became the newsletter writer for the League of Women Voters. Mm-hmm. And then there was one time I was writing three newsletters.
Oh, wow.
The third one was for an organization, a school's organization at the state level, the Educational Congress of California. And Elaine Brockbank, who was a trustee in the TAM district, had recruited me to do this because she began reading my email, my newsletters. It had the California School Boards Association, the California Teachers Association, the AAUW, the League of Women Voters, the PTA. It was a fascinating, and focusing on the crisis in the public schools. And I would point out that to become an advocate for the public schools was really quite remarkable for somebody who came from a setting where everyone went to private school, mm-hmm. so you wouldn't have to mix with the riffraff.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, there wasn't all that much riffraff in Mill Valley, but I was going to say, point out that one of the changes in Mill Valley is there aren't any poor people living here anymore.
Yeah.
That when I drive around Mill Valley and look at the houses now, every house is as clean as a whistle, spiffy, beautiful, landscaping. They look new, or anyway, fresh.
Mm-hmm.
There aren't any. I can't find old houses in Mill Valley.
They're there, but they're going fast. Right. Most of them are up in the hills now.
So in a way, it's very comfortable to drive through Mill Valley, mm-hmm. and everything looks nice. But it also points out that the kind of separation that is going on everywhere,
mm-hmm.
has been taking place here. And including that there aren't any young people who join the League of Women Voters.
Now, you joined the League of Women Voters about the same time you joined the PTA?
I probably didn't do it quite then because I still had an infant at home. But it was soon after. One reason was, oh, I know why. The PTA is a wonderful organization, but they were very much sort of... they were unsophisticated women, not in Mill Valley, but at other places. And the difference between the way the League of Women Voters lobbied in Sacramento and the PTA was extreme.
Mm-hmm.
The PTA was naive and unsophisticated in its way politically, especially at the state level. But the League of Women Voters was, red hot, and ardent. So I wanted to be part of that, and so did, all the trustees belonged to the League of Women Voters, and they saw that as a place for volunteer types, community activist types, to be effective,
mm-hmm.
At the state level.
Before I ask you about your experience with that, because that's such a big part of your resume or whatever you want to call it, I wanted to go back to something that you said to me when we were having coffee one day about this feeling of being able to reinvent yourself in California versus these expectations of what would become of you when you
right.
were in the East.
Right.
Because it sounds like you were a little resistant to California, but you did find this to be true. So could you talk a little bit about that? And
there are still ways in which I wish California had the same kind of intellectual sophistication.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not extreme at all, and there are people like me that I can find with no problem. But it's a result, I think, of wealth and When we pat ourselves on the back in Marin and say we had the biggest voter turnout in the state, I think that the turnout is what it counts is how many voters have college educations.
Mm-hmm.
The people who have college educations feel entitled to vote, and also that it's a basic responsibility that other people don't feel the same way.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think we should boast about voter turnout. We feel that the government's ours to tell them what to do.
Right. a little bit more about what Mill Valley was like in the 60s before we go on.
Yeah.
It was less populated, certainly. And it sounds like there was a lot of political chaos going on,
yeah,
both in the schools and I imagine other places. Downtown was actually still a commercial area for people that lived in Mill Valley more, right? I mean, they used it more than they use it now. Right. So are there anything else? State of mind?
Traditional. One of the changes that I've been thinking about was that it was the time when women began to wear pants instead of skirts. That it was all right to do it, and it was... It was a statement. At Radcliffe, we were not allowed to wear pants unless the thermometer was below zero, not just below 31, but below zero, or we were on the quad where the dorms were. So that was a statement of liberation. And also then women began to run for political office. They began to run for the school board and the city council, and that was really quite thrilling.
And that started right around 69. Is that
the six? It's certainly. I suppose if I went back and looked through things, I could tell you.
Well, I think Vera Schultz had already been on the city council because she ran for the supervisor by 1969.
Right.
I think, but she was the exception. So,
right.
So it was more. It became common for women to run for office, and
women were really present at these meetings, at school board meetings. The school board meetings were huge. It was scary for people who were on the school board, and there was because of how large the turnout was.
And was it often rancorous?
It was.
And was that,
especially if there were people were being asked to sacrifice, say with the closing of schools. And the fact that what Prop 13 did, this is another thing that brought, you know, the right-thinking people together. I don't think I've ever worked harder than in the campaign against Prop 13, which was located in the building owned by the California Teachers Association near its Civic Center, and the turnout at these kind of meetings was just awesome.
Yeah, that was 72 or 73.
78 was 78 was Prop 13.
Oh,
and
yes,
we
after
have,
I remember. Okay.
We still haven't recovered from Prop 13.
No, we're gonna talk about it, but I don't want to jump 10 years ahead. I'm not ready to do that yet. So there was a lot of rancor in the school board meetings because the conservative parents weren't excited about the way the classrooms were being run. Everybody was upset about school size. Student body reducing and the schools closing, and there was a third thing you said that was an issue that caused a lot of problems.
Well, it was the
proposition. What was it?
Sorano versus Preed.
Okay. How do you spell Preed?
Priest.
Oh, Preed is priest. Okay.
It is priest.
Okay.
So. Also, that The hippie movement. Mm-hmm. One of my favorite teachers at the middle school once said at a school board meeting, "I have in my class a little girl who comes to school every day with her hair neatly braided, wearing a slip under her skirt. Mm-hmm. And next to her is a little boy who hasn't had breakfast, whose parents send him to school only because the law requires it. They regard school as an establishment trip, they just want you to leave him alone, and I'm supposed to come up with a curriculum that fits these two children."
Okay, let's talk about that period. This I'm glad you brought that up, because you have a very good perspective on that. The hippie movement, as far as its influence on Mill Valley, as I understand it, really began with the Summer of Love and the Back to the Earth movement. And a lot of people discovered that they could live for free or cheaply in the old shacks and cottages and stuff up in the mountains. And they started either living in those old unconverted barns and shacks, or they would set up small communes in larger buildings. So this was the first time, right around then, I'm paraphrasing, tell me if I'm right, the first time that a relatively traditional middle-class bedroom community started seeing this influx because of the closeness to nature, and San Francisco equally brought all these free love children into Mill Valley. Is that about right? Did I have that about right?
Right. It was the sense of discarding the rules and setting new rules.
But were the people that had already been living in Mill Valley beginning to change, or was it the arrival of a new group?
Well, certainly, yeah, I think, for instance, young couples, there begin to be a lot of failed marriages.
Mm-hmm. So that would be the people that were already here, were having
that's right.
Est and stuff like that.
And it was from women becoming rebellious, and children becoming rebellious, mm-hmm. and questioning the things that you had already had up until then observed. The teachers having the power to bargain collectively was also stirred up a lot of anguish, and that they were going to have a kind of power that they hadn't before. In fact, the district responded to the anguish that the public was expressing about collective bargaining by letting us sit in on the bargaining for a year, which I did was the most boring thing I have ever done. And I also observed that the best teachers did not want to be on the bargaining team. So often it was the crappier ones who were. Right. But I can't tell you how much it stirred up people who had regarded teachers as more passive and more obedient and not so not had such a sense of their own rights, mm-hmm. right? So that split the community too between the liberals and conservatives.
Right. When you'd have these little kind of wild thing type kids that the teachers were describing next to the kids that came sort of less challenges or whatever. I mean, were these children coming from the new immigrants into Mill Valley?
Not so much. I think it was the standard, the same kind of families who, for the same reason of not wanting to have their children go to private school in the city, but come to the better schools out in the suburbs. Because there was quite a growth, mm-hmm. of young families moving to the suburbs.
But they came for the schools.
Yes, they did. So in a way, they were disturbed that that there was turmoil.
So I used to be a hippie, so I'm trying not to use the term derogatory, too derogatorily, but let's go back to that image anyway. You've got this hippie kid. Now, who were his parents at that time? Were they newcomers probably, or what?
They were often quite young, that they had gone through, in my family, I was a conservative and my younger sisters were the liberals.
Mm-hmm.
There was a generation split along those lines, and it was going barefoot. It was smoking marijuana also, and that I wanted to say was another thing that was disruptive, the arrival of drugs.
Mm-hmm.
I know that my son had his first marijuana in fifth grade.
Mm-hmm.
And having kids who had gone into the business of selling drugs,
mm-hmm.
That was one of the things that was causing real anguish. And students died of overdoses or car accidents. They weren't doing well in school because they were stoned. And there were tremendous accusations from one family to another about their attitudes toward it, even providing it or permitting it. That was, I guess, the permissive was the one of the war words.
Yeah. How did you feel about it all at the time?
I was very, very negative about it.
About the permissiveness.
About that kind of permissiveness.
Yeah, right.
Right. Mm-hmm. And to have kids who weren't being encouraged to do well in school because it was what they teach in the schools is crap.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So having the dichotomy between the girl with the slip and pigtails and the boy with torn clothes, it was very unsettling, and many teachers just were falling apart trying to and were being criticized for.
It wasn't a financial division, it was a lifestyle division.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That's right. But it was definitely, I think you would say that the Republicans were not nearly as affected as the Democrats, and responding to it in the same.
Mm-hmm.
The Republicans were just horrified.
Right.
But there weren't that many. Actually, it was beginning to change in Mill Valley. I think that Mill Valley becoming a Democratic majority,
mm-hmm.
is one of the striking changes of my time.
And that was around 1969?
Well, let's see, 1967. Certainly, as we went through the
war. Well, Nixon resigned in
70. And the impeachment.
Yeah. That was 74? What was that? When was that?
When was the war?
But that was when the shift politically. Actually, I think the demographics proved that out, that it was actually the Nixon election.
Right.
Okay.
And certainly there are towns in Mill Valley, in Marin County, that are different politically from each other, but by and large, not nearly to the extent that they were.
Now this is a good time to go into your work with the League of Women Voters. You've been a major volunteer and leader in the Marin League of Women Voters for over 40 years. How many years has it been?
Let's see. I think it would begin in about 1972,
okay.
I think. Certainly by 1975. And by 1978 and Proposition 13,
mm-hmm.
I became one of the lead speakers, debaters.
Did Prop 13, was getting involved on that campaign the thing that kind of ratcheted up your involvement with the League?
Yes.
Okay, so let's talk about
seeing that. The inside, when I joined the League, and explained the Serrano case, I was tagged as an education specialist and was the chairman of the League's Education Committee for a long time. And it involved Serrano, but then collective bargaining and all sorts of school school issues. Integration was also going on. And Tam High was the really the only high school in Marin County that had black students. Mm-hmm. So we were much more keenly aware of the issues of desegregation. Mm-hmm. And some of the people wanted the schools to go easier on black students. Mm-hmm. So that they wouldn't fail as much in mm-hmm. in school.
And let me just sort of, for the record, put in here that one of the issues with the Tam High School being more integrated was because the majority of the black kids that were going to Tam came from Marin City, which was the site of low-income housing developments. And so all of these kids were coming from, well, most of these kids were coming from basically the projects.
It was because the kids who live in Sausalito go to Tam High. Mm-hmm. And there was some gerrymandering going on mm-hmm. because if the Tiburon and Belvedere wanted their own school district and they wanted their kids to go to Redwood and not go to Tam. Mm-hmm. And our attitude was, well, let them go. At that point, we don't need it. But I was regarded as an education specialist, and at one point was not only going to all the Mill Valley school board meetings, but all the Tam High ones, and I was writing the whole Tam family. Mm-hmm. One of the influences of the League of Women Voters was their statement that good information makes democracy work. Mm-hmm. And that filled me with a sense of mission, mm-hmm. that what I could do to make democracy work was to provide good information. And I put a tremendous amount of effort into that assignment. It was as if it was religious feeling, even. And I was doing very well. The whole Tam family won a prize for the best newsletter, PTA newsletter in the state twice, mm-hmm. and the League of Women Voters newsletter which is called The Voter also won a state prize.
While you were editing it,
right? Mm-hmm. And I was actually not so much editing as writing it. Mm-hmm. And that made me feel good because I come from a family of writers. Harking back to my great-great-grandfather, William Lloyd Garrison, who was the founder of the New England Anti-Slavery Society and wrote a newspaper called The Liberator. And he has a statue on Commonwealth Avenue in Boston, near the Boston Common. And when we drove down Commonwealth Avenue, we would roll down the window and yell, "Hey, Grandpa!" But the sense of writing on behalf of democracy, what you could say, was my religion.
It's a good religion.
That's a good religion, right? Yeah. And it also created something else in my life, which was a computer. Mm-hmm. I didn't buy the first Macintosh. I bought the second Macintosh and put out my newsletter using a computer. That was, I cannot tell you how it changed my life.
I can imagine.
Because instead, I don't know if you remember mimeograph stencils, where the typewriter makes holes in the stencil, and that's with the words. And I did think, actually, that one or two prizes that I won was because of the look of my newsletter, not just what it's, the content of it. Writing for a cause was, in fact, I became too intense. There was one dinner when I think it was during the Prop 13 campaign or one of them, when my daughter Robin yelled at dinner, "Oh, Mother, I'm so sick of your high horse." And I had to laugh because I think I was getting sick of it too.
I know the comments. I recognize that in myself. But it was tremendously important what you were doing. And so you were already. So let's talk about Prop 13 a little bit and your involvement in that. And you seem to have been able to understand the potential devastation and see it coming in.
And it continues.
So what was it like to be?
So we have a house in Mill Valley, 3,000 square feet, on a third of an acre, where I can go out of the driveway and walk to the top of Mount Tam, golf course, parks. That cost $53,000. And because of Prop 13, our property tax base is based on the value of the home in 1975.
Right.
So our house is assessed. We bought it in 1968. In 1975, it was assessed at $125,000. And our property tax is based on that.
Mm-hmm.
So that our property tax has just reached $4,000.
So
and the neighbors who next door, from their property tax starts at $20,000.
Yeah. Now,
for similar
then,
property.
Yes. Well, the it's ridiculous. I know that part. I mean, but when you were fighting the campaign against it, that's kind of what I wanted to hear about. How it failed. They won. Prop 13 won. But what was your experience of trying to convince people to vote against it?
Well, for one thing, I predicted what I've just described to you.
Mm-hmm.
I was once, Pete Palches, the superintendent, took me to talk to a Rotary. And I talked about the way Prop 13 was set up, that your house wasn't reassessed until you sold it. It could go, your assessment could go up 2% a year. But, the market was going crazy. I pointed out that there was a gas station at the corner of Camino Alto and East Blythe, at each corner, four gas stations. And if one of them is sold, its property taxes will take a huge chunk that the others won't. A simple kind of prediction. And I heard one of the guys say, "That's a very intelligent woman." And I wanted to say, duh!
Yeah.
But it was that kind of thing. And then the fact that it was the son of Prop 13 and the grandson of Prop 13 that said that your children, if they inherit the house, mm-hmm. their taxes don't go up to the true market value.
Right.
And then another one that the grandchildren, if they... It was... A protection that was entirely unfair.
And so
it wasn't as if the property tax didn't need to be have some changes made in it,
right.
Because we were going through a period of inflation.
Right.
Whip inflation now, it's a button that's on President Ford's lapel, whip mm-hmm. inflation, so that people's property taxes were going crazy.
Right, so some kind of middle ground would have been reasonable. So after Prop 13, what happened in Mill Valley, and how did it show itself?
It had a tremendous effect upon the schools.
Mm-hmm.
because the schools no longer had any control over the property tax. The property tax had been turned over to the state government. Mm-hmm. It was Jerry Brown's job now about how the schools were funded. And instead of it being mostly local funds, it became mostly state funds. Mm-hmm. And for reasons that I don't really understand, there are still low-wealth school districts where one district has a lot more money. Novato has never caught up to the others, so it's something that I haven't really been able to understand why the state wasn't able to make a difference so the schools were more equal. But the schools also began to fall behind the schools in other states, and it became very, very extreme. Mm-hmm. To the point that California, with the greatest university system in the world, began to be 49th in funding of the elementary schools, public schools.
Then, were you still involved with the PTA?
When Philip graduated from high school, then I pretty much moved on, and I really had been giving more effort to the League of Women Voters.
So you weren't necessarily in with the parents at the time that the cuts were being made on the schools. That was...
Yeah. I mean, the school budgets, it was devastating. Yeah. And it certainly contributed to the turmoil, because the school district had to be a beggar to the state. Mm-hmm. And with the money went a loss of freedom. So that is, mm-hmm. right.
I'm sorry. I keep interrupting because there's so many things I want to ask you.
Go ahead.
First I want to, I like to always skip, I want to get this quote in because I didn't put it in my book when I wrote about you. When I asked you, why you, besides the fact that as an officer in League of Women Voters, you can't run for office. But when I asked you why you never run for office, you gave me the answer that, can you remember?
You can't cry at school board meetings.
Yeah.
When people are being mean to you.
Yeah, you didn't think that you could keep from crying because people would
right.
be mean to you.
It was that I was, I was too fragile in that regard.
Mm-hmm.
I did not think I could bear the criticism and the stress of it. Right.
So now I did want to ask you a little bit. You have been in a great position to be an objective observer of Mill Valley's politics. Now I know that you've worked for the League of Women Voters for Marin for all these years, but you live in Mill Valley and you certainly have been able to observe Mill Valley politics.
Not very closely, though. And the reason is that I think the city is so well run.
So let's just talk about some anecdotes, moments that you remember in your years of watching the politics from the outside.
I don't know if I can describe the sense of change taking place in the same way that I can in the schools.
Mm-hmm.
That there was no doubt in my mind that Mill Valley was better governed than many of the other. That it hired wonderful staff. Mill Valley wasn't a government that I needed to worry about nearly as much as other levels of government.
Mm-hmm.
Good people ran. If there was a bad person on the board, that person was generally a minority of the, outvoted meeting after meeting. That the input that comes from the citizens in Mill Valley watching them approach the microphone and make a lot of sense. City Council has always been extremely respectful in the way that it answers questions and challenges. I have to say that it's a government that I haven't worried about. It's one of the charms of me that I'm not very often aroused.
Can you tell me some of the civic leaders that you most admired over the years?
Right. One thing that is taking place with me as I approach my 80th birthday in April is that I don't remember names as well.
Well, I'll throw some out, but I don't want to.
Well, the one that first came in my mind was her name begins with K. Not.
Let's see. Kathy Barnes.
Not Kathy Barnes. She's.
Oh, I know. God, now I can't remember.
She's even on Faith Foot. Kathleen.
Yeah, Kathleen.
I think of Kathleen Foot.
Thank you.
Kathleen Foot. As one of the stars. And as a matter of fact, she called me once to recruit me to run for the council. She talked for 15 minutes about why it would be good for me. And I said, no, I'm too happy with the League of Women Voters. Joan Bosnecker is another standout. I would need to see lists to tell you who were the ones.
Oh, yeah, Ann Solum.
Ann Solum was, oh, yes. She had a kind of, she's typical in the way that she comes with so much that she's already done, that she brought to it, including that she'd been on the board of the library first, but also dealing with politicians. Yes, that I think a wealth of experience is one of the things that I would say that our city council members bring. They are mature when they come, mm-hmm. and experienced.
Do you think that's still true?
Pretty much.
Do you think there's been a change in what motivates people now to run and serve on local politics?
Right. Are you talking about Mill Valley?
Well, you know, I'm always talking about Mill Valley in this context. Let's stick with Mill Valley if we can.
There are different ways of deciding to run, and one is that you decide yourself, and then because you know what you want to do, you know what's going on wrong, you know what you want to do. But there's another kind where people who don't want to run recruit others.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that goes on a lot also. I don't know the extent to which people move from being commissioners, planning commissioners and other commissioners and then go on. That probably happens a lot too, that they've been active at lower levels, and so they sort of graduate to the city council. I think they've chosen wonderful city managers.
Mm-hmm.
I have a feeling that the city council chambers has a powerful effect on people who are in it.
Mm.
When I go up the stairs or watch people come up the stairs, chat, they enter that room and their voice falls as if they're entering a church.
Mm-hmm.
It was I feel it was almost, you know, designed by God himself, the way, the effect that it has on the way the people, what it does to their voices, mm-hmm. how they feel somewhat embraced. They're sitting in pews.
I never really thought about it. I mean, I haven't been to that many other city council chambers in Marin, so I don't know what they look like.
Right. Well, when I go there, I feel that I have reached a really special place, and I think that people who are on the city council are affected by it.
Well, this is kind of the perfect time to just sort of wrap up, because you've given all of your talent and education to this subject of democracy, and a lot of what you've done, I imagine, is directed toward change in the state level, but you had a lot of influence in Marin, and
including, instead of running for office myself, being a facilitator of the election process.
Yeah.
Right. But I thought about having a daughter who is a minister, and her father's Jewish, but she's not, you know, doctrinaire very much.
Mm-hmm.
But that she, I feel about, I'm an atheist. And I feel about government the way she feels about the church, that it's a religion that needs to be protected, defended, explained.
Yes.
Right. And I tell people, democracy is my religion.
Now, we are not going to include in this too much, but just for the record, because there's going to be a transcript of this, we're talking during the first 2 months of Donald Trump's presidency. And so it can be an interesting time for someone that's working on the League of Women Voters, because it doesn't feel right now like the average voter is particularly educated in basic civics and government. So what's your feeling about that?
My husband teases me about something that I have said, that I have observed reading the history of countries and governments. And that is that countries begin, they may achieve greatness, and then if you look at countries like Spain and Turkey that ruled the earth, after a while they decline. And it's, my husband says it's the part of the belief of Spengler, and he calls me my little Spenglerian. But I do feel that Donald Trump seems to bolster the feeling I have that America may have reached its peak in history.
Did you have that? That's a very short run, isn't it? I mean, if you think about between Britain and Rome and the Ottoman civilization and so on, I mean, 250 years is a long time.
Well, things move faster. Anyway, it's certainly on my mind that that our country I wonder if a country begins its decline, can it recover?
Mm-hmm. And do you think that part of it is that we have neglected civics in the schools?
You know, people constantly say to me, the schools don't teach civics. And I say, the schools teach civics. It's a legal requirement that they teach civics.
Mm-hmm.
The question is, do the children listen?
Mm-hmm.
Do they feel it? And as a matter of fact, when I work at the polls, which I don't do anymore, if a young person came in to vote, we would go bananas. We would give all our cookies away. We would sing to the young person. We don't, young people don't vote. We I go to talk to a class about democracy, and they are not interested. And I don't know if that's still true. But Mervyn Field said to the League of Women Voters once in a talk that people go along not being very interested until they have their first baby. And then he did this pantomime of a husband saying, where do I vote? Where do I run? Or something like that. That it is a, considered an adult occupation.
The last question then on that subject is, you know, lots of people like Obama are saying there's still a lot that you can do on the local level. And that's all, that's really what you've been doing for 40 years. So
right.
Can you just say something about, do you agree? Do you think that we can make a significant difference on a local level? And
yeah.
Is that a good place for people to
yes.
put their frustration?
Absolutely. Make if you make local government work, then local government won't need the state and feds nearly as much.
Mm-hmm.
However, one of the things that is disturbing about this is how different the states seem to be.
Mm-hmm.
And I look at the behavior of the southern states, and I think with deep regret the Civil War isn't over yet.
Mm-hmm.
We are still a divided country,
mm-hmm.
by geography even.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I do think that if you are attentive to your government at the local level, then the national and state level doesn't need to come down and discipline you and order you around.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, well, we're pretty much done, Annie. And
good.
I know that you told me, well, I don't know how much I can talk about Mill Valley because mine's been more of a state and county level, but you've lived here all these years.
Right.
So I always ask the same question. If you had one wish for Mill Valley, for the future, what would it be?
To stay the same?
Mm-hmm.
I don't. In a way, I'm uneasy with how comfortable it has become.
Mm-hmm.
That is, I'm not my beliefs are not challenged very much at Mill Valley,
mm-hmm.
And we've become more and more similar.
Mm-hmm.
I'm much more comfortable because we all are alike, or
mm-hmm.
more alike. But that also makes me uneasy because we're alike because of our income makes us alike.
So what would you wish if you could wave
right.
a magic wand and have one big change?
Well, maybe that there's more diversity in Mill Valley, though our kids get more diversity if they stay in Tam High.
Yeah.
And not just black kids, but kids from West Marin, kids from Sausalito.
And economic diversity could be accomplished by
diversity.
Some. How do you feel about housing? Do you feel that it's an important element that should?
I don't know how you solve that problem if you have the strength to prevent I'm struggling over the word not diverse but small building units. If more
infill. Yeah.
No, but not infill. What we fight against now is having more people living in smaller spaces.
Uh-huh, yeah.
I know the word is there, but I can't find it. That
density.
What?
Density. Yes.
Politically, density doesn't work in Mill Valley, and
mm-hmm.
I think that density. You need to allow density in order to have more economic balance.
Yeah.
But even in Marin density, even the small places cost a lot. So that's something that we have become too much alike.
Yeah.
But it's more comfortable. I mean, I feel I don't have to worry that much in Mill Valley. Living in an upper middle class community, but on the other hand, then others are excluded, and that so my democracy worries are
mm-hmm.
It's a struggle for me.
Yeah.